we're back here for another episode of Midwest Swing. You can find us on Twitter at Midwest Swing Pod. We're part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. You can find Cold Omaha on Twitter at Cold Omaha MN. If you like Cold Omaha, you can support us by going to coldomaha.com/Amazon. Whether you use Amazon Prime, Amazon Pantry, any of the Amazon features that you like, nothing changes for you, but it is our affiliate link, so we get a little bit of a kickback in terms of finances, so you can help support our podcasts, video content, and of course, our written content. I am your host, Brandon Warren. You can find me on Twitter at Brandon_Warren. We're in the same place, but there is a different face behind the producer's chair. Tom is off gallivanting in the Lord only knows where. And in the producer's chair, you might remember him from the wake-up call Sundays on 105 The Ticket, the now-defunct 105 The Ticket.
You're going way back with that poll.
Sam Ekstrom, at Sam Ekstrom on Twitter. Is that right? All one name?
Yeah, one name, S-A-M-E-K-S-T-R-O-M. Good to be on for some baseball talk. I got to get in the flow of things. You know, I might be backing you up at some point this season. I got to get out of my football and basketball rut and listen to some hardball talk with you and Matt here.
Well, and so it's a deep pull. It's a deep burn. Yeah, you might have to back me up for a similar reason, too, that our guest today is getting very excited. We've got the Alec Baldwin to our Saturday Night Live, our number one recurring guest, Matt Trueblood. How are we doing today, Matt?
I'm doing well, but Mike Berardino just sat up and went, something's wrong.
I feel like, yeah, I guess maybe he's the Alec Baldwin, maybe you're like the Steve Martin. Maybe we could do that. I guess I think of Mike as a regular, like a featured player, like the Jerry Gergich to my Leslie Knope. Maybe I shouldn't call him Jerry because I've watched a lot of Parks and Rec, and Jerry gets a lot of grief and guff. But it's great to have you on. And so what I teased was that you are making an addition to the family here in the very near future, and that's exciting. My wife and I spent our entire Sunday 7 hours at a baby class. So everything you can imagine from the preparation, you know, getting your house ready to handling a newborn, crash course, and so that was kind of wild. And I understand you are adding, like we are, a little lady to your family.
Yeah, baby girl coming in a little over a week.
How are you preparing for that? I mean, what are you expecting different from a little girl than from little boys?
You have to wipe the other direction.
Yeah, that's about it, probably.
Literally the only difference I'm gearing up for, and we'll see where it goes.
Oh, good. So that's very exciting. We're doing May, and you guys are very close here. It's going to be an added bit of excitement in addition to baseball ramping up here with pitchers and catchers reporting this week. I did see you at the Winter Meltdown, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago? And how did you enjoy that?
That was great. Yeah, I got to I worked for Aaron Gleeman at Baseball Perspective.
Yeah, that's right.
We email and Twitter each other all the time, and I met him in person for the second time ever and the first time since we've actually known each other. So it was cool.
It is fun to place a name to the face and a face to the Twitter handle and all that stuff. So you and I have done that a number of times, not only at Target Field, but also I think did we do one podcast recording in person? I think maybe. I can't remember.
Yeah.
Maybe at the old house there when we used to do the breakdown when we had you on for the first time. And so always fun to put a face to, you know, the takes that we see online, which is a lot of fun. You did, though, you mentioned Twitter. You did take a bit of a Twitter break. How did that go for you? Because I know I've found increasingly that Twitter is not a very happy place, and so I've been tailoring it to make it a happier place for me. You can take that however you want. But sometimes a clean break for a little while is good, too.
Yeah, it was great. there was kind of a mixture of things. I cut it off for, I don't know, 3-4 weeks, something like that. Had planned to just be done with it. I got some advice, and it just that fairly inactive account would be better than none.
Yeah.
But also that, especially in my case, maybe an inactive account might be better than an active one.
Yeah.
So I've been trying to follow that rule. It kind of sucks you in, but I it's a complicated thing. Complicated world, and I find I'm more productive, and I think a little more clearly and a little more openly when I'm not spending all my time on Twitter. So I try to avoid it, but it's a part of what we do, as you know pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of an echo chamber, and I think it kind of echoes, to double down on the word echo, I guess, the kind of people we surround ourselves with, we can become deluded a little bit into thinking we're the only people that exist. And that's a dangerous mentality, not only in baseball, but in life in general, politics, anything. If you allow yourself to kind of close your mind, that's a dangerous thing too. And so I've tried to kind of revamp my Twitter experience and tweet less so that I tweet less, say more. More substantive tweets, I think, Sam.
Well, the saying used to be, you're the average of your five best friends, but it's becoming, you are the average of your 5,000 Twitter followers.
Yeah.
And usually that's not a great place to be.
No.
If my Twitter is anything like your Twitter.
Yeah. Well,
I was afraid you were going to say I'm the average of my five best tweets, but I was really, really in trouble. Really.
Ooh, I would be as well.
Yeah. I would too. Oh, man. So obviously people know you best for your Cubs work. Between BP Wrigleyville, Baseball Perspectives proper, and Twitter especially. So I did want to talk to you a little bit about the Cubs offseason. I'm sure we've talked about it a little bit as well, but now we are pretty much to the witching hour of the offseason with teams breaking camp here this week. What I want to ask you is, overall, what did you come away, how are your feelings with this Cubs offseason? Because when you win the World Series, you can go a number of different directions. If you look at Pecota, which we're going to break down in detail here in a minute, Cubs aren't projected as the team with the most wins. And that doesn't necessarily make a big difference as far as who has success in the postseason based on divisional play and all that. But, fairly decent offseason. There weren't a ton of needs on this team. But I do want to see how you saw it from your vantage point, because obviously I trust what you have to say about the Cubs.
Yeah, I mean, basically, like you said, there's a lot of different ways that you can go after winning a World Series. Fans will forgive you for most things, and unless you're the 97 Marlins and you tear apart the team immediately upon winning, you have a lot of leeway.
Mm-hmm.
The direction the Cubs decided to go, because a lot of their key parts are pretty much set in stone. These guys are going to be around and around for a long time yet. So they basically set out and said, we don't even need to worry too much about the long term. We're not going to plan for creating sustainable competitiveness because we feel like we're already there.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go out and try and secure the next ring. And so that's what the winter was about. That's why you trade 4 years of Jorge Soler for 1 year of Wade Davis. And it's maybe why you pass up a Jason Hamill and instead add some depth to your bullpen and add a veteran presence like John Jay instead of letting it just sort of sort itself out in center field. So that's the direction they went. And to the extent that that's what they decided to do, I think they did it well. I'm not sure it's exactly the way I would have done it, but I don't have enormous complaints about their offseason writ large.
What is your take on this thing that came out with Hamill lately, that there was some kind of rift between him and Joe Maddon? The initial report with Hamill was that the Cubs were doing him a favor because they couldn't guarantee him a rotation spot. Now the story sounds like he might have been a little bit upset with Maddon. I didn't dive into it real close, so maybe you can break it down better. But it sounded like there was something between him and Maddon that popped up as well that might have been a factor.
Yeah, spring training is a wonderful time of year.
Yeah, all the writers are in the best shape of their lives, I guess.
They are, and they bring out some very strong reports that if you were paying a whole lot of attention, everything they're writing is something you already knew. Jason Hamill and Joe Maddon, it's not that they don't get along. I think they like each other quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But going back even to 2015, there was a particular start in which Maddon pulled Hamill in the fifth inning of a fairly close game when Hamill thought he was pitching pretty well. And it began a trend where, as the season would go along, 2015 and then last year as well, Hamill started very strong. Then he would start to fade a bit. And Madden's trust in him just evaporated immediately each time that happened. He might have very well been right. Very, very well. Could be that that was the correct evaluation of Jason Hamill. And Madden had experience with him going all the way back to when they were together in Tampa Bay.
Yeah, I was
going
to ask about that. They wondered if anything could be back to that, because I think it was 2008 or 2009. I think 2008 he was the manager there.
No enmity grew out of that, but it's just they have this long history. Madden really feels like he knows when Hamill isn't going to be able to help him anymore, and knows maybe that Hamill won't be aware of that until well after Madden is. And so he's very proactive about getting Hamill out of games. The Cubs decided to leave him completely off their postseason rosters rather than moving into the pen. And Hamill was—he was a great sport about that. He's a very good teammate, a very good clubhouse citizen. But it created a division. He didn't really want to be on that team anymore.
I got a question for you. Was John Jay really necessary for this team?
I don't know. I think we'll find out. Sorry, one second. Got a little bit of that cold.
Yeah, I hear that. Good thing we're not contagious over the microphones here. Although the microphones might spread something internally here, but let's hope not. Knock on wood.
Can't blame me for that.
Yeah.
Jay is what he is. He's not a very good defender in center field, which is basically the only place that, given this roster, you would want to play him.
Yeah, was he like sixth on the depth chart for left and right?
Yeah, something like that. What he does do is bat from the left side and put up pretty good on-base percentages more often than not, can make some contact, and by all accounts, great makeup guy. He's going to...
It helps he signed a one-year deal instead of a multi-year deal, too.
Certainly, yeah. And I think they didn't have any interest in bringing back Dexter Fowler, not because they didn't love Dexter Fowler and the things that he does, which are considerably more valuable than what Jay does. It was about... We just want to give one more year to figure out what we have in Albert Almora and to see whether maybe our corner outfields are going to solidify and we might need to put Jason Hayward in center, even if Almora doesn't work out. So they wanted the year to figure that out, and Jay is a good way to do that.
Like a good hedge.
Yeah, exactly. He's an insurance policy against Almora really struggling to figure out big league pitching. But when Almora is in the lineup, as with Jay, they're going to bat near the bottom of the order anyway. So as long as Almora is playing really good center field defense, you should still see him plenty.
Well, if Jay bats in front of the pitcher, takes some walks, in addition to his usual walks, it might not be a bad place to rebuild value, especially in an offense that's bound to score a ton of runs. And, you look at this depth chart. I've got the MLB.com depth chart in front of me. Literally every player listed is a fantastic player. Like Tommy La Stella... isn't a throwaway player by any means. He's a nice utility player. Maybe he doesn't appreciate being a utility player, but in this roster, obviously a very good utility player. The roster is incredible, and it's got to be a luxury for Madden to fill out these lineups, where he can just plug and play based on matchups, ride the hot hand. It's going to be a situation where I feel like every day he's going to have two guys on the bench that are going to be chomping at the bit for plate appearances late in the game, not only for the pitcher, but maybe if a defensive guy is in there, Jay in center, they want to hit and then bring Almora in. He's going to have a lot of options to play chess in the late innings.
Yeah, and that's the way the Cubs want it to be. One of the reasons they wanted Madden so badly is what he's able to do with position players, resting them more often than a lot of managers can get away with or even are interested in doing, and playing matchups in a smart way. Mm-hmm. And so they've got a lot of different pieces that fit together in different ways, and they know they've got the right guy making those decisions. It's a fascinating roster. You're right.
What's your level of concern for Kyle Schwarber? My contention is this. In a small sample size like the World Series, again, he obviously had a fast track to get back there, and it's impressive, but there isn't enough time for rust to show as well. And I've kind of thought about it in the Jason Kubel kind of thing, where he tore his ACL and came back and had an entire year he lost at the big league level. Now, again, Kubel maybe not the wasn't the caliber of prospect of Schwarber, but Kubel really mashed in the minor leagues. So I don't think it's completely an inapt comparison. And so I just wonder, should there be some expectation that he could be rusty this year and will need to work through some things?
There's uncertainty. I don't know. I don't think that the Cubs have any expectation that he's going to fail or even struggle all that much.
Okay.
They're ready for it, and mm-hmm. they won't be alarmed if it happens. But they're extremely confident in Kyle Schwarber, the hitter and the person. Just his makeup matches his ridiculous ability to make hard contact to all fields. And he's got a great approach, too. I kind of agree with your Kubel comp, and just the Kubel was a good player who didn't stay healthy for as much of his career as he would have liked to,
mm-hmm.
and that eventually ate away at his considerable offensive value.
Well, and his athleticism declined. He had a great arm. He could play right field.
Right.
And the other thing was, he was measured in the same vein as the Mauers and Morneaus. I mean, that was the third name. That was the third amigo. And so it was a deal where that really messed him up, and he became a guy that couldn't post more than, you know, 2-3 wins above. I think a 2.3 was his record when he had a monster season at the Metrodome, and it was just a deal where he just couldn't move anymore.
Yeah. I think Schwarber's a better player than that, and more mm-hmm. importantly, a better athlete than that.
Right.
Just that Kubel, pre-injury, was a guy who was only going to be in a corner and didn't run very well, even though he threw well and his instincts were fine. Schwarber, I think because he had an ugly showing in the 2015 playoffs in the outfield, and because he'd been a catcher and people knew that he wasn't a great defensive catcher, that people don't realize what kind of an athlete Kyle Schwarber is. He's a former linebacker. He, in his only substantial big league sample, was an above-average base runner. He's not blazing fast, but he gets moving, and he has great instincts. And I think he has a lot of ways to affect the game. So barring another catastrophic injury, I think he'll rise to a higher level than that. But there is that kind of risk.
Is the best case scenario with him that he's a Cub for many, many years, or he plays well early this season and eventually gets moved for, you know, maybe just to reallocate the assets, maybe find a really nice, young, cost-controlled starting pitcher, you know? Hypothetically, maybe he gets traded to the Rays and can DH or play first base for them. I'm just talking in hypotheticals.
Yeah.
What is the ideal career path for him as you see it, even if it doesn't mean sticking with the Cubs?
Well, the ideal career path, the thing that is not remotely off the table, is multiple MVP awards growing out of an elite bat
mm-hmm.
that can do everything. And I think in any scenario where he rises to that level, he's still primarily a left fielder and a decent one. And he may even catch every other week or something. That's not off the table yet, at least. Will that be with the Cubs or not? I definitely think so. They're head over heels for him within the organization. And just because of all these flaws that we can all kind of see, even if we don't always know whether or not they're going to rear their heads, the trade value might not be quite what we think it is. So I would think he'll stick around, and I think he can be really, really good. But that ideal, it's always risky, you know, reaching that ideal level of performance is not necessarily likely.
What was your least favorite Cubs move this offseason?
Oh, Soler for Davis.
I felt like that was kind of a layup, but I still kind of had to set you up for that, for the assist.
Yeah, Wade Davis is a great pitcher. The Cubs satisfied themselves about any concerns around his health, which I'm going to go ahead and trust in just because they've had a really good track record with that stuff over the last few years. Really, over the entire time since Epstein and company have taken over the organization. But he's still a relief pitcher. It's still a one-year deal. They still gave up on a player who has a whole lot of potential that he hasn't reached yet, and maybe he never will. but it felt like that was maybe an asset worth holding on to or trying to turn into a starting pitcher, even if it meant adding another prospect to that package.
Does it help at all that they traded from a surplus, or is it still kind of kind of sticking your craw a little bit that it just wasn't the perfect deal for you?
I mean, it can't not help. This is a thing that happens to good teams, and even will happen to bad teams as they amass talent in preparation of getting good. You reach a certain level, and your roster, be it the 25-man or the 40-man, simply won't hold all the good players you have in your organization anymore.
Yeah, I feel like the Dodgers have that happening too.
Right. It happened to, I think really notably, happened to the Rangers 5 years ago or so. And they didn't handle it perfectly, and that's how the A's slipped by them for a little while, because mm-hmm. Their roster management was phenomenal. But, it's a thing that's going to happen, and if you can see it coming, as the Cubs did, you can find ways to either take three players and turn them into one really good player and save yourself some roster spots that way, or you just trade from an area where you know you have a surplus to help yourself in an area where you still have a lot of uncertainty.
Well, and as always, it's better to make a move too soon than too late.
That's certainly true. And there are a lot of people who would argue that trading Soler was a move that they made too late. I tend to think you could have waited, seen if he would really break out this year. But a lot of folks thought last year, after he was great in the playoffs, and it seemed that the only thing holding him back was health, that you could have gotten more for him then.
Was it simply the ability to play center field that kept Almora in favor of Soler? Or did it help the Royals to see that Soler had some big league success, or at least had played in the big leagues more, in your opinion? Or what do you think went into choosing who they did to move him based on what they needed to do to get Wade Davis?
The Cubs chose to keep Almora and move on from Soler because they love Albert Almora. His makeup, his instincts, his ability to adjust at the plate, and the way he plays defense. They don't think he's merely good out there. They think he can be well above average as a defensive center fielder on an everyday basis.
That's pretty important.
Yeah, and they don't have the same confidence in Soler, and in particular in Soler's willingness and ability to condition himself in a way that will keep him healthy and to make changes to especially his swing path to adjust to the way that pitchers have been exploiting him. So it's not that they don't like Jorge Soler. Certainly the Royals, while they would have taken Almora, did like Soler, or they wouldn't have traded Wade Davis for him. But the two players are, I would say, almost by industry consensus, Almora is better than Soler and has a brighter future.
What was your favorite move the Cubs made this offseason?
Good question.
That's tough. I mean, there are a few that were interesting. I know they don't always have to be high-end moves, too, because I was breaking down the Blue Jays offseason last night, and I actually think TJ House was my favorite move for them just because of the minimal risk. So if it's a lower-end move, it's not going to surprise me.
Yeah, I think what I liked most was maybe their last move of the winter, which was they traded Donnie DeWeese, who is maybe a future fourth outfielder, maybe a future left fielder, kind of the guy that can play it for you even when you're good, but you're always looking to replace him, mm-hmm. that kind of player. And they traded him for Alec Mills, who finished out a winter of amassing minor league pitching depth in the event that their starters get hurt. Mills is from the Royals system. He's got four pitches, and a couple of them are above average, and he really repeats his delivery, fills up the strike zone. Those are things that the Cubs love, and the fact that they found those traits and acquired that kind of player at a relatively low prospect cost is impressive and valuable.
Yeah, the minor league numbers are impressive. 8.6 strikeouts per nine, 1.9 walks per nine. Good ERA, up the ladder, started the whole way pretty much. A little bit of relief time in there when he first joined the Royals farm system. But that looks like a guy who, if they can't help you on the back end of the rotation, could definitely see their stuff play up in a very, very solid bullpen role as well.
Yeah, he had a little velo bump in the minors this last year. So the thought is neither of his breaking balls is stellar, but he could be that 96 with a plus changeup who comes in and can get batters out from either side of the plate in the middle innings if that's the road he ends up on.
So let's break down Pakoda, obviously the big or one of the big things that happens every offseason. I guess it's not the big because the top 101 is big, and a lot of things are big at Baseball Prospectus every offseason. The top 101 came out on, was it yesterday?
Yeah, yep.
So yep. Monday. Obviously a big thing for fans of all teams. I believe, am I mistaken when I say there were two Twins on the 101?
You are not. Yeah, okay, Nick Gordon and Tyler J tucked in at the end.
Yeah, they picked Tyler J. I know Baseball America had Steven Gonsalves, but very similar. A lot of people are upset. Oh, well, what the heck? The Twins aren't very good, and they have no more prospects, and they're kind of freaking out like, well, what the heck? What happened? They had a great farm system 3 years ago, and it's like, okay, well, here's the deal. All those players that made up that great farm system are in the big leagues now going through their transitions. That's why the team's not very good, and that's why they're not prospects anymore. And so now it's like, it's not really an assembly line where you just stay as the number two farm in baseball. I mean, unless you're the Dodgers, of course. but I think that people are getting worried about as much ado about nothing, because the Twins still have, you know, outside of the super hyper elite teams like the Cubs, they have as much young talent as more than a more than average amount of young talent that's just unrefined talent and no longer prospect eligible. Would you say I'm getting close to what you might say there?
Yeah, they're an interesting organization, and anytime you graduate Byron Buxton and Miguel Sano and Jose Berrios, your farm system is going to get substantially weaker.
Mm-hmm.
Especially because they had that weird hiccup of the 83 wins in 2015 that took away their chance to add elite talent through the draft this past summer.
Right.
So it's a kind of a conspiring thing. And remember, you know, we always have to remember that prospect lists are a snapshot, and that in June, after the Twins picked first in the draft, they're going to have another top 100 prospect. That's almost inevitable.
Hashtag Hunter Green,
two,
right?
Depending on how they use them. Yeah, well, we'll see.
We will see.
My draft preparation ramps up about Memorial Day. The draft is the week after.
Yeah. Oh, so. Yeah. Me too. I just hear his name and Jaron Kendall, and then I think Alex Fiedo, the pitcher, as well. There's a few names floating around, but nothing real concrete. It's just that if the Twins can add Green, who throws over 100, and maybe he won't continue to do that, that sounds like an interesting thing to me. Plus, he follows me on Twitter, so I'm biased.
Yeah, so it's going to be interesting. But they shouldn't be thought of as a team that's old and without young talent. Now, that's not to say they're not in a precarious position, because there's been a, if not a failure, then at least a setback in player development, where these guys have graduated, but they haven't turned into the players you hope they're going to be yet.
Right. You got to find a way to mold them.
Right. So hopefully that changes under the new front office. But that's really where the risk lies. It's not in not having enough young talent. It's in the question of whether or not they're going to make the most of that talent.
So fans that don't necessarily know much about Baseball Prospectus will say, well, what the heck does Pakoda mean? It's about Bill Pakoda, right? I mean, it's inspired by Bill Pakoda, the utility infielder for the Royals, Braves, Mets for 9 years back in the mid to late 80s and then the early 90s. What goes into Pakoda, the preparation to make Pakoda what it is?
Sure. Well, Nate Silver developed this, and this was back, oh, we're more than 10 years, but I don't think we're to 15 yet. So about that long ago, he first developed it. Not really inspired by Bill Pakoda. They just, I think it stands for player empirical comparison, something that starts with, oh, test algorithm. The
sure.
idea was, let's create an acronym that spells out some random player's name.
I like it.
Yeah, I do too. And it's what that sounds like if you speak mathematician, where it's going to take a player's performance and some underlying performance indicators. It's going to take into account the basic vital statistics that we have on all players: position, size, handedness, and then it's going to adjust all of that for their age and the way we expect players to age in terms of their performance, and compare them to similar players throughout baseball history and try and spit out. One of the neat things is that it doesn't spit out one number. We get a tiled, sort of a percentile list. Here's what happens if this guy goes nuts and performs at his 90th percentile expectation. Here's our average expectation, and here's what happens if he craters. So that's about what it does, and it does that for every player in the league and a whole lot more. And after that, we tinker with the system by saying, this is how much we expect a guy to play and where, and where he'll bat in the batting order. And then it tells us how many wins each player is going to create, how many wins a team is likely to amass. But you can hear through all those steps where there can be distortions.
Sure.
So that prediction is, the team level predictions will always be much less accurate or meaningful than just individual ones about how a player is going to perform.
Projections in general seem to skew conservative. Maybe that's just my view of them, but I feel like, you know, so last year there were six 90-win teams. This year, Pagoda projects five. So that's fairly close. And again, I'm using last year and this year, so maybe that's an inapt comparison. But only one team, the San Diego Padres, is projected to win under 70 games. Last year in the major leagues, seven teams did so. So it feels like things kind of bunch around the middle a little bit. And again, maybe that's just how projection systems work. But in your experience or in your opinion, why do they skew kind of conservative?
Well, it's a response to empirical observation. We know that most of the time, if a guy had an extreme performance in a given season, whether it was good or bad, he's going to regress a bit. He's going to get closer to average the next season. And because, let's say he was really, really good, I'm trying to think of a player who busted out unexpectedly last year, but Daniel Murphy's a decent example.
Yeah, I think it's a good example.
Off the charts last season. But Pagoda looks at him and says, he also had many years before that of being a certain kind of player who wasn't at that performance level, and we expect him to come back to the pack. At the same time, because he was so good, he's going to play even more than he did last year as long as he's healthy. And so this kind of aggregation of players who played really well or really poorly, being pulled back toward the center just by the gravity of how baseball works, also pulls team records closer to 500 than we observe in reality when we're trying to project them in the future.
So I'm sure you don't have Pagoda, the site in front of you, but can you think of any teams that it surprised you how well they projected? I think obviously the Minnesota Twins are going to be on your list. We can break them down as well. But was there any team that really stunned you with how well they projected out?
I don't know about stunned. At the higher end, we tend to be more, oh, that's really good, where I only thought they'd be pretty good, kind of.
Like the Diamondbacks, maybe, or the Rockies, 78 and 76 wins, respectively?
Those sound about right to me. Both of those teams have improved since last season.
Okay, about the Marlins at 78?
That one is interesting, right? Because we know they're going to have to try and bounce back from a tragic loss and also just a huge loss in terms of who they are as a team.
Right.
Not having Jose Fernandez. But they took steps in that direction. Edinson Volquez and Dan Straley, give them a starting rotation that you can squint and think, yeah, that might work. They already had a pretty good bullpen last year. They bring back basically intact what was a pretty impressive group of position players. not just Stanton and probably a full season from D. Gordon, but Martin Prado and
Yelich is really
Yelich
good.
And, yep. Yeah, so
Ozuna really turned it on last year.
Yes, he did, although he's also so inconsistent that it's
yeah, that's true.
He's one of those guys where you have to keep the error bars really wide.
I like Justin Bour, too, or Bauer. I don't know how you say his last name. I think it's Bour, but he's good against right-hand pitching. They do have some pieces that all mesh together well where, yeah, I mean, 500 doesn't seem out of the realm of possible.
Right.
How about the Tampa Bay Rays at 84 wins? I broke them down last night for Baltimore Sports and Life. I think they and the Yankees are probably the two teams I think will finish in the last two places. It's always hard to do that division, though, because all five teams could be decent. Tampa Bay Rays at 84 wins. I think you can squint and see that with that pitching staff. And they always seem to hit on one weird free agent signing, whether it'll be Colby Rasmus, Logan Morrison coming back. Wilson Ramos was an awesome risk for them, I think, just based on the risk-reward potential of their season. What do you see from the Rays that makes them an 84-win team, possibly?
Unappreciated depth. For one thing, we have Kevin Kiermaier being something close to a 7-win player.
With defense, man.
Right there. Yeah, he's a phenomenal defender, and I think that's, you can make a case that that's a perfectly fair expectation, but I think most people would be inclined to reel that in a bit, and then you're already bringing them down basically to 500.
Mm-hmm.
But what they do have, for the first time in a while, is a pretty good, pretty deep farm system, and some players who are kind of right on the doorstep already. Willie Adames is one of the better shortstop prospects in baseball.
I think Daniel Robertson's pretty interesting too, isn't he?
Yeah, exactly. And if either one were to assert themselves as ready this year, which isn't out of the question, they'd actually have to push through a decent collection of talent that's already sitting there in Matt Duffy and Brad Miller. So
yeah, Nick Franklin's not nobody you can shake a stick at either. He had a decent year last year.
Yeah, Nick Franklin, I could be wrong, but I think he's got a weird, even odd year thing. He's, again, like Marcell Ozuna, so inconsistent that he's hard to count on. But that's why having good players who are right on the cusp of the majors is valuable, because if a guy like that craters and you find you're unable to even continue playing him, you've got a replacement who isn't truly replacement level.
Yeah, so I think I could buy them at 84 wins. I think a lot of things would have to go right. 82 wins for the Yankees, yeah, I could see that. I don't think they're going to be better than last year because of how they did kind of a mini teardown, but it's an interesting team, especially, and I don't want to pick at a scab, but Gleyber Torres probably not too terribly far away. And then is it Clint Frazier they got for Andrew Miller? They got some interesting guys on the way up. The pitching staff, though, if they lose Tanaka, who can opt out after this season, I don't know what you're going to do, because then you've got Michael Pineda and CC Sabathia. I don't know if Sabathia is a free agent after next year, but they've got a whole lot of nothing in that rotation if Tanaka leaves.
Yeah. Well, what they do have is a whole lot of young arms, and so the future is still probably bright there. They're going to have to continue using their resources, spending heavily and trying to even sell off some parts to get more young arms, because you can never have enough, especially when it's sometime in the next 2 years. And like you, I can't remember exactly when it is for everybody, but you're probably going to lose Tanaka, Pineda, Sabathia, all of them. So they're going to have to replace an entire rotation. But
they did prepare for that with the Justin Wilson trade, where they got, I think, Sessa and was it Chad Green? I know they got Sessa, they got Chad Green, and they got is it Brian Mitchell? And then I know they've got who was the other guy I really liked? Adam Warren. I wanted to ask you about, because I think he played for the Cubs for a while, didn't he?
Yeah.
Is he interesting or not really?
His evil twin might have played for the Cubs for a while. He was terrible in Chicago. He didn't have command of his fastball. He wasn't missing bats, and he wasn't throwing strikes. You can't be a whole lot worse. But you could see something in him when he was out there that, you know, there was a decent pitcher hiding somewhere under that mound of lost confidence. And when he returned to the Yankees, it kind of came back. So, yeah, Warren is a guy. They've got Justice Sheffield and
James
Kaprielian and this stable of guys who are not going to be ready in 2017. And the reason that they're projected well in 2017 is more because they went out and got some players like Matt Holliday, who I think a lot of us, knowing, frankly, a little more than Pecota does, just in terms of injury, where he is injury-wise, and what's going on with his body. Pecota is more likely to look at Matt Holliday favorably than we are.
Well, and I think $13 million in that market, the way market shook out for bat-first or bat-only guys, you know, they did a good job by countering that with Chris Carter.
Right.
$16 million for those two combined, yes, I can buy that. $13 million for Matt Holliday, I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, well, and Pecota, though, kind of likes that ploy because it sees experience and it sees a track record of success, and not just with them, but with Chase Headley. And it remembers the good Starlin Castro. And it looks at all of these guys, and it sees probably a little more competence than we expect from them as a group. And Pecota might even be right about that.
Mm-hmm.
That's why, even as they've sort of gone into rebuilding mode, the Yankees haven't had a losing season over the last few. It's been right around 500 because they've got some competent veterans on hand, and they just keep making that work while using their financial resources, especially, to build up their farm system again.
So let's hone in on the NL Central, obviously the division that you're going to be most vested and interested in. They've got the Cubs running away with it by 10 games over the Pirates. They have the Cardinals 76-86. I don't know if you've been near Twitter. Maybe I'll drop a bombshell on you, but it sounds like Alex Reyes is not well and might miss the season. They're having an MRI today, and there's some people citing their hashtag sources that he's got a very bad injury. 76 wins for the Cardinals. I just feel like they always find a way. Pecota hates their defense, which I could see that. But do you think the Cubs are going to run away with this division? And do you really feel like the Cardinals will finish behind the Brewers or even with the Brewers?
To the second question, no, I don't. I think the Cardinals will be an above 500 team.
I just feel like they always find a way. They always find a way. It's like their devil magic.
Yeah, I think, again, there are just things that Pecota can see and things that it can't see. And one of the things it can't see is that Aledmys Díaz really improved as a defender as last year went along,
mm-hmm.
as he kind of got the feel for the speed of the major league game. It can't see that while none of Dexter Fowler, Stephen Piscotty, and Randall Grichuk maybe project as elite defenders on their own, they form a pretty good outfield phalanx as a group. So as long as they're healthy, I think they'll catch the ball in the outfield.
So like the sum is greater than the parts or something?
Yeah, that kind of thing. And it can't see some of the other interaction factors that can make the Cardinals good in years when we don't expect them to be. They don't have a single Cardinal starter projected for as many wins above replacement as Anthony DeSclafani of the Reds.
Oh, geez.
Now, I'm not saying that can't be right, but Carlos Martinez is a fascinating case. He's this guy who everything he throws moves, everything he throws sinks, but he doesn't miss a ton of bats. He's small. The guys he tends to get compared to are guys who have had some injury issues, and we know that he's had some himself. He relies a bit on his defense. He relies quite a bit on his catcher. We released pitcher command numbers at Baseball Prospectus. That was one of our other big days, or weeks in that case, this mm-hmm. winter. And Martinez has crummy command. But sometimes the stuff is so good, and he's working with a catcher who is so good, that it just doesn't end up mattering. And that's why, despite those flaws, he's been a really good pitcher for 2 years. So there are things like that Pecota just misses, just because of the nature of a statistical projection system. The Cardinals, I think, will win more than they lose, although I'm a little bit heartbroken at the news over Alex Reyes. He's a sight to behold, and I hope that those reports turn out to be either wrong or just
overblown.
Yeah, let's hope for that.
Well, and you looked at it. You look at their entire rotation, and there's question marks. Adam Wainwright with age, Martinez with, you know, I think he has these stretches every year where he just kind of blows up and is really good. Mike Leake, basically, how good is he? I mean, is he? Could he be another Rick Porcello? And then which Rick Porcello can he be? Lance Lynn coming back from injuries. Michael Wacha's got the shoulder issues. There's a lot of things at play here.
Yeah. And I think it's good to keep in mind how much downside there is there, because a lot of those names are famous. And a lot of those pitchers, like you remarked on with Martinez, he can look completely dominant. And there are days when he looks like one of the best starters in the game.
Mm-hmm.
But Pecota isn't wrong to note that sometimes he's also not.
He's so, just not good sometimes.
Yeah, it's good to keep the downside in mind, too. But I think the Cardinals' pitching staff and their defense will be a bit better than Pecota thinks, and it'll add up to get them into contention. I don't think the Cubs will run away with it, although I think if you project anyone else to win the Central, it's kind of a stunt.
So 99 wins for the Dodgers. If you had to pick a roster to swap, if you were the Cubs and you had to, you were forced to swap rosters with somebody, it'd have to be the Dodgers, right?
I think probably so.
I mean, Corey Seager's awesome, and Justin Turner's pretty good, and you know, Logan Forsyth doesn't stink. Adrian Gonzalez is pretty good. There's tons of outfielders. At least three of those guys are going to be decent. I like Yasmani Grandal. Love Clayton Kershaw. They have a ton of pitchers. There should be some help there, too. It's an intriguing roster if it's not, you know, albeit maybe imperfect because of the back end of the bullpen, but it's an interesting roster.
Well, yeah, and the first two corner outfielders who go down, you know, if that's what happens, Yasiel Puig tears a hamstring, and the guys coming up behind him are Cody Bellinger and Alex Verdugo, who are both comfortably top 100 prospects. And
mm-hmm.
Yeah, they have that insane depth that is born largely of just having so much money and being so willing to spend it. But it is extremely valuable. The Red Sox are another team that kind of goes near the top of that list, and the Astros. But I think the Dodgers would be the team, again, if it's not the Cubs, the Dodgers probably have the strongest roster in baseball.
So if somebody were to give you an even money bet, the Cubs and Dodgers in the NLCS or the field, how strongly would you feel about that happening?
I would take the field.
Of course. Well, okay, because of how gambling works. But, I mean, that's as likely as any matchup, right?
I think it probably is. I feel pretty good about both of those teams reaching the playoffs. The Dodgers are projected by Pecota to win their division by something like 13 games.
Yep, 13 exactly.
Yeah, that's always jarring to see, but it doesn't necessarily feel wrong to me.
It's obscene, and yet it feels right.
Right. The Diamondbacks and Rockies are on the rise in an incremental way. The Rockies are going to be really interesting in a couple of years. The Giants are still good and can contend for a wild card spot, but barring really good health for the Giants coinciding with poor health for the Dodgers, I don't see how they beat the Dodgers. So they're going to be in the NLCS or the NLDS, and then it's always a coin flip, but the Dodgers are as good a bet as anyone to move through that round just because of the way their roster is built. And the Cubs are, if anything, even more of a lock to get as far as the NLDS, and then you kind of, you know, it's random from there, but those are going to be the two best teams in their playoff matchups if they're not facing each other.
Okay, so before I let you go, let's talk about these Twins for a couple seconds. So the big jump, I wrote before I knew any of these projections that the Twins would win 80 games this year. I felt pretty good about it. I didn't get a ton of heat. You know, you'll get a lot of the dummies that'll be like, LOL, you're delusional, you're in the Twins
right.
pocket, which if I was in the Twins pocket, I wouldn't be writing for these people, but you know how it goes. But if I was lying, I was dying. I thought this was a team with a lot of potential, and I think what we saw between 2015 and 2016 was the variability of young talent, and if you are resting your hopes on a lot of young talent, you have a very wide range of outcomes with how good or bad you can be. You know, I think the 2015 team, which I thought largely overachieved and was probably more of a 70-something win team, you know, it was largely the same team that came back. I mean, they lost Blaine Boyer, not a big loss. Torrey Hunter, you know, in the clubhouse, there's that argument. But on the field, Byung-ho Park should have been able to replicate that production.
Right.
That was basically the transfer that was made. I just felt like we saw the entire range of possibilities based on what can happen when you have a lot of young players who you entrust very large roles to.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much exactly it. And you're right that the Twins, who won 83 games, were not an 83-win team. They weren't even a 500 team.
Right.
That's just, they had a really hot streak in May, and the season stops after 162 games, no matter how cold you are. So they never, things never really evened out. And so that team was always going to regress. It got horrible just because of a string of things going wrong for them. And, you know, they didn't do a whole lot to protect themselves against those things going wrong. And some of them were foreseeable. But a lot of it is just that there can be a wide variance. You can find yourself then in July knowing you're not going anywhere. And it's time to do things like trade away Eduardo Nunez and turn over shortstop to Jorge Polanco and let him learn on the fly. Stuff like that eats into your win total, even though it doesn't make you a worse team. And so it was a combination of factors.
Is Jason Castro the only difference between this Twins offseason being a Falvey Levine offseason and a Terry Ryan offseason? It kind of feels like
feels
it to me,
way.
Honestly.
Yeah. I wonder, this was a very Terry Ryan-esque offseason,
mm-hmm.
but I'm not sure it's the offseason that Terry Ryan would have had if he were still in charge at this time. I think their refusal to overreact to 103 losses, their willingness to be patient and to not just take Jose De Leon when the Dodgers kept kind of nudging him across the table in exchange for Brian Dozier.
Yeah, he probably got a little bit carsick being shuttled back and forth in those trade talks.
Yeah. I think sometimes the best trades are the ones you don't make, and I don't know that the Twins end up getting something better than De Leon for Dozier, but I think they had every right and even a best practices obligation to hold out for more than that,
mm-hmm.
and they still have a perfectly good chance, if he has the first half that I would expect from him, to turn him into something at the deadline, especially now that Brandon Phillips has been dealt and not to a contender. So.
Right, yeah, it opens up the ability for somebody else to need a second baseman, or say Jason Kipnis gets hurt, or you know, and I would never wish ill will towards Jason Kipnis, but that's the kind of thing that happens.
No, because that guy's awesome.
Right, he's fantastic.
Yeah, that kind of thing. If it happens, then the Twins will be in a good position.
So here's the big thing that sticks out to me: 22.7 fielding runs above average. That means the Twins are projected to be the second best defensive team in the American League. I think moving Miguel Sano to right field is huge, but how much is this driven by hoping, obviously, full season of Byron Buxton center, Eddie Rosario being a good defender that had a bad defensive season last year? Is Jason Castro driving some of this? What all is going into this?
Yeah, I mean, basically, this is an average or maybe even slightly below defensive team, but with Jason Castro and Byron Buxton on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the value of elite defenders, which is what those two are. Castro, you know, he's not at the level of a Buster Posey or a Yasmani Grandal or a Yadier Molina, but he's a very good framer. His throwing is fine. Not going to hurt them.
Mm-hmm.
And just being able to create more weak contact, get more looking strikeouts, all the things that a good framer can help you do, has a lot of value.
But who stands to gain more from that than a team that's consistently dead last in strikeouts?
Oh, yeah. And a team, I don't know what it's going to end up, what the rotation will end up being. No one does right now.
Right.
But let's say Kyle Gibson is in it. Kyle Gibson is this really interesting pitcher who in 2014 and 2015 was kind of a poor man's Dallas Keuchel or Francisco Liriano.
Oh, man, I've been saying Keuchel for a while with him,
yeah,
that kind of deal.
pounding that area just below the knees with sinkers and sliders and not missing as many bats as maybe those guys do, but being able to hopefully get a ton of ground balls and a fair amount of strikeouts. But when you have a poor framer behind the plate, it doesn't go that way. That kind of pitcher relies on pitching, frankly, outside the strike zone. And if Castro can earn Gibson the strikes that he needs to succeed, there can even be this sort of compounding value added. So I think Castro can make a bunch of these pitchers better. And if he does, then the Twins are going to realize real gains in run prevention, which I think we should forecast anyway, because these pitchers just aren't that bad. And now they also have, led by Buxton, a very good defensive outfield and the strongest collection of outfield arms in baseball. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I talked to Jack Goin at the end of the meltdown, and I just kind of bounced some ideas off him. I said, you know, with this Castro move and then nothing much else, I feel like it's a year of transition. They're going to manage Paul Molitor's going to manage as a quote-unquote lame duck. He's managing for his next contract or to find out if they're going to get their own guy, whoever it might be. But they owe it to each of these pitchers to say, here's the deal. We want to see what you're capable of with a very good defensive catcher. And we're starting from scratch here because Kyle Gibson can be a lot better. Got that first-round Mizzou pedigree. Jose Berríos may stand to gain a ton from pitching to a much better catcher. You've got Hector Santiago is so weird. He's like the anti-Ricky Nolasco, out-pitching his FIP rather than the other way around. Each of these guys has a lot to gain. And Jack said, you know, that's right, too. And then just from a foundational standpoint, a catcher who's going to command our pre-series meetings and is going to be able to revitalize our pitching staff as the foundation. And I think that's an interesting way to put it, that I think, you know, he'll provide his value that we can dictate based on his war or whatever. But what he gives to each of those guys to raise their water levels is going to fly under the radar a little bit.
Yeah, and the reason that we don't necessarily try all that hard right now to quantify stuff like that is that we don't know just how good or bad Chris Suzuki was at that. We know pitchers loved working with him. He may have not allowed them to game plan in the same way against opposing hitters, but there may be other ways that he helped those pitchers and kind of made up for some of that. But there's no question. Castro's he's a good catcher. You can play him as close to every day as you would want to play any catcher. And he should help the pitchers in multiple different ways and make this team better, you know, as a defensive unit.
Now, let's close with this. John Ryan Murphy graded out really well on your guys' catching metrics last year defensively from a framing standpoint. Right-handed hitter, so they could do a platoon between Murphy and Castro. Do you think that would be a pretty good setup behind the plate?
I don't know.
I mean, there's potential there for it to be, for them to cobble together their own version of like a Russell Martin on the cheap. Now, I'm not saying that's a likely thing, but that would be the ceiling. Hey, two great framers. If Murphy can learn some game prep stuff from Castro, because most of that's probably words as opposed to, you know, stuff you can learn intelligence-wise. Obviously, learning from the Stanford guy is going to be a big deal. But a lot of things you can learn as opposed to physical stuff that's tougher to learn. I just think there's potential that they could have crafted a brilliant, cheap platoon behind the plate.
Well, there's no question. I wrote about this with regard to the Cubs because last year they had Miguel Montero, David Ross, and Wilson Contreras splitting their catching duties. All three of them graded out as above-average framers. And there is an extra dimension of value that's added by being able to play your matchups offensively or if you know that this guy needs an extra day of rest and still put in a player who will also help you defensively. Having two great framers is more than just additively more valuable than having one. The problem is we just don't seem to know very much about John Ryan Murphy. Every time we think we do, he violates those expectations.
Yeah.
So I feel like I have no choice other than to wait and see with him. But it's certainly an interesting gambit, and and could be really valuable if Murphy turns out to be able to hit anything like a major leaguer, and if he can translate those, like you said, pretty good framing numbers, especially in the minors, into major league framing performance.
Do you think it's going to take a little while for Castro to learn this staff, and maybe the framing returns will be, you know, a parabola towards the end of the year where it gets better as the season goes on? Because I guess that's the one thing that confuses me a little bit, or confounds me about, is it going to take him a little while? And then second of all, I always wonder about what role he played in making Colin McHugh a better pitcher, or Dallas Keuchel, as opposed to, you know, if they made him look good, he made them look good, or if it was a little bit of both. I'm just intrigued, because if he made Dallas Keuchel or played a big part of that, that's why it could be interesting to see what he could do for Gibson.
Yeah. I think when you make a signing like this, you commit 3 years to a player, a veteran catcher who, like you said, has a pedigree of intelligence and leadership, that you kind of expect him to be doing his homework, to come to spring training, and to figure most of that out before the season even starts. So I would think you can be even more optimistic and say Jason Castro is going to be the catcher he's going to be starting on opening day for these guys. I might flip it around and say it could take some of these pitchers, especially Berrios and maybe Tyler Duffy or whomever might fit into the back of the rotation, it might take them a little longer to learn Castro and to learn the sequences that he can help them succeed with where they might have failed with Kurt Suzuki. So that kind of stuff might take a while. But, yeah.
Well, what I appreciate is that they've given me plenty to write about in the early season when the statistics haven't gotten to a sample size. So I'm not writing stories like I did about, oh, maybe Pedro Florimon is good. I don't want to have to write any of that stuff. So, Matt, thank you for...
No, you never want to write that.
No, Matt, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy day to join us on Midwest Swing, and we'll have you on again real soon.
Hey, sounds great, man. Always happy to do it.
You've been listening to Midwest Swing, part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network.